Welcome to KiteLine, a weekly radio program on WFHB that focuses on issues in Indiana's prison system and beyond.
I'm Emma Johnson.
And I'm Mia Beach.
And we're your hosts for this program. Behind the prison walls, a message is called a kite. Whispered words, a note passed hand to hand, a request submitted to guards for medical care. Illicit or not, sending a kite means trusting that other people will bear it farther along until it reaches its destination. Here on KiteLine, we hope to share these messages with you across the prison walls. On this week's episode, we continue to focus on the experiences and struggles of women and families who are affected by the prison system. But first, here are some local and national updates about incarceration and law enforcement. The following is an excerpt from a piece by Carl Taquet of the American Civil Liberties Union.
Earlier this fall, the U.S. Department of Justice Inspector General released a scathing report on the Federal Bureau of Prisons monitoring of contract prisons, a shadow network of private, for-profit prisons that hold about 11% of the nation's 193,000 federal prisoners. The report shows how the Bureau fails to impose basic standards of health, safety, and human decency on the private companies it pays to run these prisons. In one example, the Inspector General recounts how a prisoner who told medical staff that he was having trouble breathing was refused immediate care and told to fill out a written request for an appointment. Untreated, he died. Afterward, the Bureau of Prisons conducted a mortality review that criticized this denial of care but did not propose any specific corrective action. As a result, the Inspector General writes, "Contractor deficiencies went uncorrected and corrective actions were delayed, putting other inmates at risk." The Inspector General's report recounts a litany of such potentially deadly deficiencies, ranging from medical care to violence to the misuse of solitary confinement cells as overflow housing. The profit motive is an unstated but ever-present connecting thread. Using solitary confinement cells as overflow space, for example, was something that private prison wardens conceded was not a good correctional practice, but which they engaged in because the company's contract with the Bureau encouraged them to continue accepting new prisoners regardless of whether they had the space to house them humanely. Similarly, medical understaffing, such as one prison's decision to go without a full-time physician for 8 months, seems to persist because it is cheaper for the private prison company to pay penalties for understaffing than to provide adequate medical staff. The Inspector General also reports that the private prisons experience 9 times as many lockdowns as Bureau-run prisons and significantly higher levels of violence than Bureau-run prisons. To prevent these abuses, the Inspector General issued a series of recommendations to the Bureau to develop better monitoring of its private prison contractors and to convene an internal working group to examine why the private prisons perform worse than their publicly run counterparts. However, they avoid confronting the larger question of whether it makes sense to continue the federal government's multi-decade experiment with prison privatization. Even public prisons are secretive, unaccountable institutions that tend to resist reform. Citizen observation and activism, exemplified by the use of cell phone videos to build momentum for police reform, are next to impossible in a place whose very purpose is to assert total state control over the bodies of the people inside it. But when a for-profit company takes over the institution, this inherently closed nature shields the activities of an entity whose primary duty is to deliver value to its shareholders. The conflict between that profit motive and the legitimate goals of government forces a constant arms race between the contractors, who must seek new creative ways to maximize their profits, and their government overseers, who must ensure the government is actually getting what it paid for. The Inspector General's recommendations are the latest step in that arms race. These findings, along with other recent reports and exposés, should spur officials to cancel these contracts rather than accept the human and fiscal costs of this continued arms race.
The recent presidential election results have left many marginalized communities concerned and confused about their futures in terms of federal and local law enforcement. Among these, the undocumented community is expected to be one of the most immediately affected by Trump's presidency. In a recent speech that Trump gave in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, he outlined the plan of action that he intends to execute during his first 100 days in the White House. Among the top priorities for his first day in office, he listed the deportation of 2 million undocumented immigrants, as well as the cancellation of pre-existing visas for those who would not be accepted back into their native countries. He also promised to, quote, suspend immigration from terror-prone regions where vetting cannot safely occur, unquote. In response to Trump's threats against immigrant communities, an organization called Movimiento Cosecha, or the Harvest Movement, has gained national attention and support as they honor the work and legacy of undocumented immigrants. Members of the movement have been responsible for organizing many of the Sanctuary Campus and Sanctuary City demonstrations that have occurred across the country, during which people have come together to demand that university and municipal administrations publicly commit to refuse to cooperate with or aid U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement forces in the event that Trump makes good on his claims to incarcerate and deport millions of immigrants. Trump has responded to this movement by threatening to defund all local governments that self-identify as sanctuary cities. On Wednesday, November 15th, over 100 college campuses participated in sanctuary campus rallies to demand that their administrations prevent ICE officers from entering university property or prosecuting students and community members. Indiana University Bloomington was one of these campuses. Here's an audio clip of the demonstration held on Wednesday at Sample Gates.
Human is illegal! No human is illegal!
No human is illegal!
Human is illegal.
Human is illegal.
No human is illegal! Sanctuary now!
According to a new report by the American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU, poor defendants in Texas who can't pay fines from traffic tickets end up in jail. Many municipal courts in that state, the reporter says, fail to consider the defendant's ability to pay fines and fail to consider alternatives such as community service to resolve those cases. The ACLU issued the report on November 3rd, when the Texas ACLU filed a federal lawsuit against Santa Fe, Texas, a city the ACLU says is operating a debtor's prison and, quote, prioritizing raising revenue for the city over administering justice fairly. The ACLU found that over half of some 700 municipal Texas courts decided not to waive any fines and fees when the cases involve people living in poverty. The ACLU and other organizations have filed similar lawsuits around the country because they allege this practice is a nationwide problem.
Last week, we began our exploration of the impact of prison on families. During our interview with Wendy Middleton, who founded a program called Angel's Wings to help incarcerated mothers and their children, Wendy mentioned her sister, April. I spoke with April, who works with House of Hope in Martinsville, Indiana, and is also a mother who did time in prison. She told us about her experiences and thoughts about being a woman in prison, the impact of prison on families, the work she's been doing since her release, and gives insights on how female prisoners' mental and physical health needs are addressed while they're locked up. I found it moving to be able to speak with both sisters about their experiences, so I hope you'll stay tuned to hear April's story.
My name is April Gray. Right at this point, I'm a certified recovery specialist, and I run a place called the House of Hope, which helps families of addicts recover. It helps teach them how to help their loved one who is an addict. That's what I do now. I didn't begin that way, but I began doing what I was doing because I had a boyfriend who was a heroin user a few years ago who took his own life. And I decided to change my life then. But at the time, I had, because of him, gotten some charges and went to prison. And first I was on home detention, and then he committed suicide and I just fell apart. So I went into the home detention office and told them that I needed help and I needed recovery because I just couldn't stand it to live a moment longer. So I asked the home detention officer for help. So he took me off of the bracelet and put me in jail. But the best thing he did for my life was when we went to court, he asked for purposeful incarceration to the judge, which means that I was sent to prison for the sole purpose of completing a recovery program, which I was excited about because I was a grown adult. I lived for 17 years with a husband who was also a crack addict and had abused me for years. So being the wife of an addict the loved one of an addict, I had that down to a science. So when they finally told me that they would help me and give me recovery, I was excited to go to prison. I was excited to just still get the help that I finally needed. On my son's 18th birthday, they sentenced me to 10 years in prison. But they made it purposeful incarceration so that if I went and I completed the program, then they would modify me within a year. I have three kids. My oldest two stayed with my sister. My youngest stayed with my mother. DJ and Jasmine were almost pretty much adults. Jasmine was on her last year of high school. DJ was already out of high school. They stayed with Wendy while I was gone. If you weren't in the Honor Recovery Program that I was in, and you were just part of the Open Pop at Madison, you were treated like any other woman. But in the program that we were in, we had counselors who worked really hard at getting family events in. They would have families be able to invite their children and have a big family day. And it was something that all the women, you know, would look forward to doing, so it would make them even more responsive to what they were trying to help them with, counseling and recovery, because they wanted to be able to see their families and kids. And my counselor had gotten a grant approved for a program about communication. So he got this grant approved, so they did these classes just a little bit separately. But if you graduated from these little classes, then you were able, your family was able to come in on that day, and the girls all put on a play for them. We had like a big, you know, kids' carnival thing going on. The more deeper that I got into the recovery program and I began to learn the cost it was to my children and, you know, what I've taken from them, it was very difficult. My kids weren't little, but it affected my youngest son quite a lot. My youngest son began to act up in school, began to get caught doing this and that, put on probation. He was really acting out, and I seen him taking on the role like his father, in and out of prison all his life. Okay, not mom, but now both mom and dad are not there. So with Isaiah, he acted out. So while I was incarcerated, I could not even function because I was so scared and so worried about my child, you know, harming himself or, you know, nobody paying attention to the things he was doing. And it made me feel really guilty. I had a lot of guilt and shame over that. And my daughter, I missed her whole senior year of high school. And for your daughter, you know, prom, graduation, and not being able to be there for those things, those are monumentous things to a mom. I tried to call, you know, I had a great family that are a great circle of support for me that I could call, but it was not the same. It was definitely not the same. And so when I came back home, I had a lot of repairing of those relationships to do with my kids and to assure them and to no extent that I wasn't going to be what their father was, in and out, in and out. And rebuilding trust and letting them know that I would not let people like that back into our world, into our sanctity, you know. While I was incarcerated, when my father had his strokes, one of the biggest things that changed my life was when he had his stroke, they were trying to get me out for I had already finished the program at that point. I was just teaching it for the program director and stuff. But there was a loophole in my paperwork. My mother actually had to go in to the judge's chambers. The judge himself called the prison counselor. My prison counselor called me down there to have an on-the-phone interview with Judge Burnham because he was trying to get me out and released to come home to my family because didn't know how long my dad was going to make it. But one of the worst things that they ever did was sending the sergeant-at-arms to come find me to tell me about my father's stroke, and then I had a choice to make. I had to either decide if I was going to go home and have a 3-hour hospital visit or I could wait till he passed away and go home and spend 3 hours at his funeral. Hearing my family upset, hearing my kids upset, just wanting their mom to be there because grandpa was sick. And a part of my dad's illness, after having those strokes, he kept forgetting where I was at. So he's in the hospital, and just right home afterwards, he kept telling my children to get the keys and get the shoes that were coming to get me. So my daddy, in all what he was trying to go through, was still trying to rescue his daughter. It made a big difference in their recovery. They had family to go to because they could make a plan from there. With the addicts, with people that are incarcerated, they just need to feel security and feel like, you know, okay, for tomorrow, I've got this going on. I've got this place, you know, I've got somewhere to lay my head. Women that were going to halfway houses and things like that, those are the ones that were more susceptible about coming right back because they had no security the way that I had security. Well, you keep on running. Baby, settle down. Well, you keep on running. You lose your home. Well, you keep. Well, the House of Hope is not just help for the addict. You can go to Centerstone. You can go to, you know, most places and get help for an addict whenever they're trying to get into recovery. What you can't get is help for their family. You can't get personal meeting time for their family to learn how to best help them and how not to, you know, enable them or, you know, a lot of times family members become an addict because they are spending so many years taking care of or in love with an addict. And they don't know how to set boundaries or they're not aware of how to do it. So at the House of Hope, what I do is become the middleman as a recovery specialist and be able to help parents or family members help their loved one with their addiction by not doing it dangerously, by setting boundaries and finding ways to protect them from making mistakes and adding to their addiction rather than adding to their recovery. So we do a family meeting on Thursday nights at 7 called Hope Returns, and that's for the families and the addict. So we have, I have about 5 13-year-old clients right now whose parents are either incarcerated or they are out on the limb in their addiction, and these children have came to see me because they have started acting out. I have 2 of them that have become cutters, self-destructive pain, because they don't know how to deal with their family member's addiction, and they react in the only way that children, you know, tend to react. So we do a meeting, this meeting called Hope Returns, and then I also meet with them on an individual basis to help teach them coping skills and how to best avoid not becoming, you know, what mommy and daddy have become, but learning how to prevent those things. So, and we also do monthly events that I call Families Recover Together, where all of the families that are intertwined in the House of Hope, we do fun events like last Friday, we had a bonfire and weenie roast with hay rides, and we had over 50 people there, and we ended the night by doing a candlelight vigil for those still suffering, those taken, and those fighting in recovery. I just continue to keep going because people just need to know that there's hope, and that if they speak up, you know, they can make a difference.
April also told us about some of the issues that arise when women are faced with mental and physical health needs in prison.
I think when it comes to county level, women are treated horrible. you're not treated like a human. You're treated like there's 75,000 other people just like you. You want to go in there and you want to feel like, you know, the person taking care of you actually cares about you, you know, as you as their patient. But instead, it makes you feel like you're in a warehouse. And one of the things that they did in receiving when all of us women from my county got there and we had to line up to get the pap smears from the nurse practitioner who was giving them to us, first of all, it was just nasty. It was such a hurry-up-and-go procedure. It's like it's not done in a sterile environment at all. And there was 12 of us women from Morgan County that got a pap smear that day, including, of course, about 25 other women on the exact same day, all in about 2 hours. Yeah, it was absolutely horrific. But 11 of us, 12 women, had an STD called trichomoniasis that we had received from our county jail. We all had to be treated for an STD because we got it from the county. The water was so dirty in our county jail that it had came up in the system, in the bathroom and stuff like that. It washed back up. That's how they explained it, that it had washed back up when we used the toilet. And so all of us women, you know, all but one, and the only reason why she didn't have an STD is because she had just got to county 24 hours before that. But we all had the exact same one. It was horrible. I did 19 months incarcerated. There were a lot of problems healthcare-wise while I was in prison, and several reasons why they didn't want me to be in a minimum security prison because of the health issues. Kept trying to send me back to Rockville or IWP where there's more medical care. They had found cancer inside of me in my uterus while I was incarcerated, so they treated me for that. But I did not want to leave the recovery program because that's the whole reason why I was there. So they basically did a surgery, and then I was without pain medicine and then continued to what they call cauterize the cells, the cancer cells out of me for about 6 weeks in a row there at Madison so that I didn't have to leave the program. The people at Madison were very kind to me. Once they got to know me and once that they were using me as a leader in their program, their big honor program, the director and things, you know, made it a little bit more humanly possible for me to feel like a woman, you know, and not just another number. They had to get special permission for me to use a cane in prison because anything like that, you have to be at the maximum level to use. It was part of our recovery program, you know, that a hug, you know, during like a spiritual event or something like that was acceptable. But anything past that, no. When I had the cancer and I was going back and forth to the doctor, it was really hard for me to walk. And they had to get special permission for two inmates to help walk me, basically, practically carrying me from the chow hall to back to the dorm where I was on complete bed rest. I would like to see them do more of an information check because a lot more of the crimes that lead women to prison are addiction-related, are abuse-related. So if they knew that, then they could, you know, possibly send them to a program like me. They do a questionnaire. The questionnaire is not enough, you know, to be able to go a little bit more in-depth, you know, because it's so the victims of different things could actually be served well in different programs that the prison offers if they know, they actually inquire to find that out. And while we were in intake, a lot of the women that went on to Madison with me, there were several of them that were misdiagnosed with hepatitis C because they were needle users. The prison, the intake at Rockville said, okay, automatically, you got hep C because you're a needle junkie. That's not true. So there were several women that I was incarcerated with that when they got out, received thousands of dollars in care medically to try to heal a disease that they'd never had. Hep C should only be diagnosed from a blood, you know, a blood test. And it is a result of addiction. It really is. But the questionnaire that they ask you, I can't remember, it had like 30 questions on it or something. And you know that most of the women are lying. They don't want to say, I've done this and I've done that. You know, afraid of catching new charges or, you know, being totally honest. You know, and it's just some little survey, and it's like 20 questions. Every woman is given it. But intake counselors at Rockville automatically, you know, look at that and look at you say that you've been using a needle, and automatically then you're passed on to the medical people. You're passed on to the psych people who do a five-minute evaluation on you at best. And then all of a sudden say you're hep C.
Up next, April talks about some of the things that she noticed about being a woman in prison.
Men get all, every and any thing that they could get in county, but women are not offered anything, especially in our county jail. You know, I mean, like, you can go work as a trustee, as a man. You can go out for CC, work release. You can do all of these things as a man in our county jail. And I was there for quite a while, but you cannot do any of them if you are a woman. They have always said that it's a respect, and basically they think the men behave better than the women, I guess. I don't know. But in our county jail, actually until I started speaking publicly about it in the last year, our county jail just started a residential substance abuse program that is doing well, but, you know, only 10 women get to go to it. The only thing we were allowed to do is, like, go to the Jehovah's Witness Bible study. NA or AA, they have to be invited in. We weren't allowed to go work in the kitchen. We weren't allowed to do anything to make our time any easier in county. The men, however, can. They can earn time cuts. They can work inside the jail. They can work outside the jail. They can do all of these things, but the women cannot. I don't understand why they're like that, but they are.
We'd like to give a special thanks to April for sharing her story and to her sister Wendy from last week's episode. We'll continue to share more stories about women, health, and the experiences of families affected by prison in future episodes. This has been KiteLine. Anyone affected by the prison system in any form is welcome to write us via our P.O. Box, KiteLine Radio, P.O. Box 2422, Bloomington, Indiana, 47402. KiteLine wants your feedback. You can reach us via email at kitelineradio@gmail.com or find us on Facebook. Are you or someone you care about affected by the prison system? You can call us to record a message or share a story to be played on the air at 812-269-2517. Or you can use this number to record a message to a loved one. You can find previous episodes of KiteLine or more information on our stories at kitelineradio.noblogs.org. KiteLine is intended as a means of communication between people across the prison walls. We are not responsible for all views expressed on the program. WFHB, its contributors, or any affiliates airing this program are not responsible for the views expressed on the show. This has been KiteLine. Join us every Friday at 5:30 p.m. to hear more stories, news, and insights about Indiana's prison system and its impact on our communities. Thank you for listening.